Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. We are continuing with our deep dive into Chevron deference into the 1984 Supreme Court decision. We're going to finish today. We're in Roman numeral 6 and 7, and then we're going to be done. That's really all I have today. There is something I'm going to cover coming up that is related, and it was inspired by something that John Yoo posted on LinkedIn. John Yoo, a wonderful TRP guest from 2022, on a great piece he had in The Federalist, and it's a co-authored piece. I'm not sure who the co-author is, but we'll cover that. It is related to what we're talking about here because it's about Morrison versus Olson, the dissent in Morrison versus Olson. I'm going to go through that entire dissent from 1988, which is all about the presidency and how it relates to what's happening now with Trump, what Trump should do as far as prosecuting the lawfare that was perpetrated against him. The controversy would be, I think that lawfare is the way it was done was unlawful. I've written about this in Substack. I've argued that Jesus in the New Testament was against lawfare. So I'll bring a little bit of theology into it. So would Trump be hypocritical to go after the lawfare perpetrators? John Yoo argues it's not hypocritical, it's not revenge. It would be in the interests of justice, and there's specific reasons he gives for that that I think are worth pondering on a deep level. So we're going to get into that next time before we get into Loper Bright. So hold on for that. And then an additional issue, of course, we have to finish the Snitko case. We have one more episode of the Snitko case, which is the FBI Fourth Amendment violation case that we were going into. Very interesting about the safety deposit boxes. We will finish that, I promise. We got to get into the Bostock thing from 2018. That is about gender, and it's related to this gender craze, the litigious nature of the gender thing, as it has created a kind of a hostile environment in the workplace. I would argue. The expectations about how civil rights legislation at the federal level relates to making up your own gender and expecting everybody else to fall in line with what you feel, what you're saying you feel inside about gender. Now, that's a really important topic because you wouldn't be surprised about this, but it's really about the role of Congress. You'll notice the separation of powers angle here in the Republican Professor podcast. It's one of my deals. In fact, if you Google separation of powers, individual liberty, just check it out. Just I'm going to go ahead and Google that right now, see what comes up. Okay, I'm going to do this Google search live, okay? So, because I want you to see this for yourself. And I know some of you are going to thinking, oh, you're tooting your own horn here, huh? Well, maybe. But I'm not hurting anybody. Check this out. Separation of powers, constitutional statesmanship. Let's see. I because that's what we're interested in is constitutional statesmanship. Did I misspell constitutional statesmanship? I did. Oh my goodness. I was corrected by AI, those bastards. It was my fault. I misspelled it. Okay. I'm scrolling down. Are you paying attention? Those of you on audio only, I know, are incredibly frustrated. But we're on the first page of the Google results. One, two, three. I'm just scrolling down. Four. There's Wikipedia. Five, six, seven, eight, nine. Oh, I'm down. I'm at number nine now. I'm the ninth one on the first Google page. I'm the ninth one. Right above me is Cornell Law School. Right above that is the US Capitol. Right above that is congress.gov. Right above that is the Yale Law Journal. Right above that is Wikipedia. Okay, so I'm on the first page of the Google search results on separation of powers, constitutional statesmanship. Now I like constitutional powers. I'm telling you, I've spent a long time thinking about separation of powers. Not as long as some of these guys I've written about, but and I'm going to do individual liberty, constitutional statesmanship, because I think individual liberty is really what separation of powers is all about. Let's do a Google search on this. There I am, number one. I'm the number one Google search result. I'm the number one Google search result. I have been for over a year. I think actually 2 years now. I am the number one Google search result for individual liberty, constitutional statesmanship. And you can see it's this book I've written on the separation of powers and the protection of individual liberty. Right below me is American Enterprise Institute, below that, congress.gov. There I am again, number four. I'm number one, number four. Then there's congress.gov again. Then there's Cato. Then there's Coolidge, Ordered Liberty. Then there's Pacific Legal Foundation. Then there's Nature. And then there I am again. I occur three times on the first page of the Google search results. Now, a lot of people spend a lot of money on Google search results. I have not spent a dime besides my sweat equity and my deep concern to get these things right. Okay. Let's get to it. Let's go to Chevron. Let's go to Chevron. Chevron deference. What you say, huh? Okay. Let's go to Chevron. Chevron deference. Get my lowrider deference in here. Okay. We're in Roman numeral six, which is page 853. And if you look this up on Chrome, I like the way they present it because the page numbers are on the side. I'm on Firefox and they've embedded the page numbers are a little bit hard to see within the text, but I've highlighted it here. To learn how to get to this case on Google Scholar, well, I'll just tell you, Google Scholar, cases, federal courts, type in Chevron USA versus Natural Resource Defense Council, look up 467 US 837. Look for it. It'll be there, probably on the top. 1984. Here we are. Let's get started. As previously noted, prior to the 1977 amendments, the EPA had adhered to a plant-wide definition of the term source under a NSPS program. After adoption of the 1977 amendments, proposals for a plant-wide definition were considered in at least three formal proceedings. In January 1979, the EPA considered the question whether the same restriction on new construction in non-attainment areas that had been included in its December 1976 ruling. Now we're on page 854. Should be required in the revised SIPs, state implementation plans, that were scheduled to go into effect in July of 1979. After noting that the 1976 ruling was ambiguous on the question whether a plant with a number of different processes and emission points would be considered a single source, the EPA, in effect, provided a bifurcated answer to that question. Oh, joy. Oh, joy. What could possibly go wrong? We continue. In those areas that did not have a revised SIP in effect by July 1979, the EPA rejected the plant-wide definition. On the other hand, it expressly concluded that the plant-wide approach would be permissible in certain circumstances if authorized by an approved SIP, State Implementation Plan. It stated, where a state implementation plan is revised and implemented to satisfy the requirements of Part D, including the reasonable further progress requirement, the plan requirements for major modifications may exempt modification of existing facilities that are accompanied by intra-source offsets so that there is no net increase in emissions. The agency endorses such exemptions, which would provide greater flexibility to sources to effectively manage their air emissions at least cost. Well, that sounds pretty reasonable to me, but the problem is why wouldn't that just be the answer for every source? If you're talking about applying the plant-wide definition, why to some and not to all? This is causing great confusion. Page 855. In April and again in September 1979, the EPA published additional comments in which it indicated that revised SIPs could adopt the plant-wide definition of source in non-attainment areas in certain circumstances. See, you get the impression that the EPA is just making it up. I mean, some people, they just bow to authority anytime there's somebody in authority, and they go, "Oh, okay, well, that must be right." And they just, it's like they get on a lobotomy as soon as they hear an acronym. Whether it's EPA, IRS, FBI, SIP, it's like they just go, "Oh, okay, that must be the right answer. They're the expert." And they don't think for themselves. And I'm arguing here for an electorate that thinks carefully and deeply about these things. If something doesn't make sense to you, it might not be you. That's the problem. It might no, it might, if you're an idiot, then maybe it is you. But in the Christian worldview, we're all sinners. We have all fallen short of the glory of God. We all need help. That doesn't mean that none of us is an expert, but it means that we have to be careful because all of us is interested in, we have interests. the EPA has interest too. Might not be that they have their eye on the ball. And sometimes people act like experts, and they have an expertise in one area, but it doesn't follow that they're acting in a lawful manner. And this piecemeal approach to regulation is it the trouble is people can't rely on it when they're running their business because it just starts to feel arbitrary. And arbitrariness is the very opposite of law. It's the very opposite of what we mean by under the rule of law. And besides, this is a federal agency. This is an executive agency. It's not Congress making this. These guys don't stand for election. How much is this really dictated by the president? In 1979, President Carter, was he paying close attention to this? Was he dictating, was he channeling the electorate into these decisions? There's got to be a point down the ladder of the executive branch where there's a loss of connection to the electorate. That's what people are concerned about, especially when it appears to be arbitrary and capricious. On the latter occasion, the EPA made a formal rulemaking proposal that would have permitted the use of the bubble concept for new installations within a plant as well as for modifications of existing units. It explained bubble exemption. The use of offsets inside the same source is called a bubble. EPA proposes use of the definition of source to limit the use of bubble under non-attainment requirements in the following respects. One, Part D SIPs that include all requirements needed to assure reasonable further progress and attainment by the deadline under Section 172 and that are being carried out need not restrict the use of plant-wide bubble, the same as under the PSD proposal. Well, that sounds fancy schmancy. Number two, Part D SIPs that do not meet the requirements specified must limit the use of the bubble by including a definition of installation as an identifiable piece of process equipment. Okay. Page 856. Significantly, the EPA expressly noted that the word source might be given a plant-wide definition for some purposes and a narrower definition for other purposes. I'm sorry, but that's confusing. That's what's leading to this whole thing. And maybe I'm not sorry. Why am I apologizing? You can't define something as simple as the word source, and you're expecting that there's going to be kumbaya and people, playing the banjo on the beach and singing your praises peace on earth and bubble gum and fire pits with s'mores. Come on, man. This is going to cause a lot of problems here. Source, it wrote. Source means any building, structure, facility, or installation. There's that word or again. My goodness. Or which emits, okay, which emits or may emit any regulated pollutant. Building, structure, facility, or installation means plant in PSD areas and in non-attainment areas, except where the growth prohibitions would apply or where no adequate SIP exists or is being carried out. The EPA's summary of its proposed ruling discloses a flexible rather than a rigid definition of the term source to implement various policies and their programs. Flexible rather than rigid. Oh, brother. What could possibly go wrong, guys? What could possibly go wrong? One moment, I'm going to show you part of a logic textbook. Just hold on one sec. I'm in one of my offices. I have more than one office. And this is the logic textbook that I had when I was in school studying logic. This is over 20 years ago. I still have the book. I don't throw away books. I've still got my little grades here for my professor. And I wanted to just show you how important in a standard logic book, this one is coming apart a little bit, is definition. Chapter 5 of the 10th edition of Irving Copy's Introduction to Logic, which he wrote with Carl Cohen. Irving Copy, for many years at the University of Hawaii, my friend Shannon Holzer, a guest on this podcast, cleaned his carpets when we were in college. I went to college in Hawaii, and along with Shannon, Shannon and I were in different classes at the same school there in Honolulu. Definition. Kinds of definition: stipulative, lexical, precising, theoretical, persuasive. But lexical definitions are really what you want. You want the most precise definition you can in law. That's what's going to be the most predictable for governing future action, what's expected of conduct going forward, meeting the conditions of due process, fair notice. People have to be able to organize their affairs and plan. That's the whole point of having law. So they can plan their conduct and things are clear, and they're not surprised when you flexibly change a definition all of a sudden, ex post facto. You know, we don't like that. That's not good. That's not good for individual liberty. It's not good for human flourishing. Of course, the reason we're interested in individual liberty is because of the connection it has, the tight connection it has with human flourishing. So, I mean, lexical definitions on page 127 here of Irving Copy are given themselves a definition. And I'm just going to mention it's multiple page, so I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I have before, but there are criteria for lexical definitions that you can look at. The key issue in getting a good definition is getting at the essence of what you're talking about. So that is to say, if you're defining a noun like source, you want to include all examples of the word source and exclude non-examples of the word source. That's what we mean by essence. Okay. So, for example, if you were going to define the term marriage, you want to define that noun to include all of the examples, the real examples, and exclude non-examples, because there's a difference between being married and not being married. And the definition is supposed to get exactly at what that difference is, so that you don't include non-married arrangements in the definition of married, and you don't exclude real marriages from the definition of married. And in the late controversy that we had with the definition of marriage in the United States, I would contend that the so-called marriage equality people, marriage equality, were trying to broaden the definition out in such a way that there was no limiting principle that was tethered to the reality of marriage. In fact, oftentimes I heard, seems like a contradiction, that there is a reality to marriage and there's not a reality to marriage at the same time and in the same respect. That can't possibly be the case. So that's obviously wrong. So if you think that there is such a thing as a real marriage, you have to say exactly where the limiting principle is. What distinguishes a real marriage from a non-marriage. Okay. And I think that what they did was they tried to spread it out like peanut butter so much that they lost that line. They included, or they intended to include, non-marriages in the term marriage. And that's a mistake. So that's one example I could give you from policy. A Mickey Mouse example I could give is like, okay, you want to define the term dog. Well, okay, I mean, you can imagine how this might go, you know, if someone wasn't aware of what a dog was. I don't know of a natural language speaker in the United States or anywhere else that doesn't know what the word dog means, but I mean, maybe if somebody didn't know English and they wanted to know what that word DOG meant, and you didn't have the word in their original language, their mother language, so you couldn't just give a synonymous definition, a translation. It would be similar as if you were talking to like an alien from outer space or something, and they downloaded all the parts of all English language except for dog, and there was some kind of glitch on the word dog, and so you had to explain what it was. You don't want to include cats in your definition of dog, so you don't want to say a dog is a four-legged animal. Well, that would include cats, and that's not a good definition of dog. That's not accurate because cats are not dogs, and so that can't possibly be the definition of dog. It's too broad. It doesn't get at the essence. It might capture all dogs, but it's too broad, so it's wrong and it's a mistake. The opposite mistake would be to define it so restricted that it excludes real dogs. Okay, so for example, maybe you use in your definition of dog, you use Chihuahua. You give an example of a type of dog. But the problem with there is it's too narrow. It excludes real dogs. Okay? It definitely excludes non-dogs too, but at what price? It excludes real dogs. And that's what the marriage equality people were accusing us of at the time, is that we're restricting the definition of marriage to include some real marriages, but we're excluding real marriages as well. So that was what that fight was about. Of course, getting people to describe it in that way would require an attention span and a level of non-grade inflated paying attention to like your logic book and maybe even taking a logic class. What a concept. I talked about this in logic class all the time at multiple universities and colleges for years in Los Angeles, and had wonderful discussions and paper presentations during that whole controversy. And I'm telling you, there's a lot there. There's a lot to learn. But these controversies, I would say, are just illustrative of the importance of learning some basic logic and taking the task of definition very seriously. That's the key point here. Because the whole point of this Chevron thing, the whole reason that we have the Chevron deference case is the EPA is playing fast and loose with this term source. So it raises the separation of powers question. The separation of powers question is who should be defining this term? Right? Because it's clear that when the EPA is doing it, it's leading to political disputes about the economy and the rights of citizens, not to mention how it affects so-called the environment. And these are disputes that go to the heart of who's in charge of this. It should be Congress doing this. Remember, we talked about that. It should be Congress Article 1, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution says all legislative powers herein granted. Well, they're definitely in there. Shall be vested in a Congress. It doesn't say it shall be vested in the EPA, which is in the executive branch. It's vested in the Article 1 branch, Congress, the legislature. Well, the legislature wasn't doing its job. It didn't adequately define the term source. If it had, there wouldn't have been this dispute. If they would have been following this or something like this, or, Patrick Hurley's Concise Introduction to Logic, section 2.5, it's in chapter 2, gives criteria for how to define a term to where it's not willy-nilly and you're not just making it up. It's not. So anyway, I'm hoping I'm getting through to you guys on this. Significantly. Significantly. The EPA expressly noted the word source might be given a plant-wide definition for some purposes and a narrower definition for other purposes. It wrote, source means any building, structure, facility, or installation which emits or may emit, or any regulated pollutant, building, plant, facility, or installation. Wow. Means plant and PSD areas and non-attainment areas, except where the growth prohibitions would apply, where there's no adequate SIP. The EPA's summary of its proposed ruling discloses a flexible rather than a rigid definition of the term source. This is code for rife with problems. Rife with problems. In summary, the EPA is proposing two different ways to define source. They even say that. For PSD and complete Part D SIPs, review would apply only to plants with unrestricted plant-wide bubble. Two, for the offset ruling, restrictions on construction and incomplete Part D SIPs review would apply to both plants and individual pieces of process equipment. Well, what the heck is that all about? Causing the plant-wide bubble not to apply for new and modified major pieces of equipment. Man, what the heck is that all about? In addition, for the restrictions on construction, EPA is proposing to define major modifications so as to prohibit the bubble entirely. Finally, an alternative discussed but not favored is to have only pieces of process equipment reviewed, resulting in no plant-wide bubble and allowing minor pieces of equipment to escape NSR regardless of whether they are within a major plant. In August of 1980, however, the EPA adopted a regulation that, in essence, applied the basic reasoning of the Court of Appeals in these cases. The EPA took particular note of the two then recent Courts of Appeal decisions, which we talked about those in our first episode. Ginsburg talked about them, which had created the bright line rule that the bubble concept should be employed in a program designed to maintain air quality, but not in one designed to enhance air quality. Relying heavily on those cases, EPA adopted a dual definition of source. That's the Democrats. The Democrats did that. For non-attainment areas that require a permit whenever a change in either the plant, well, whenever a change in the entire plant, right? You guys see this, right? Whenever a change in the entire plant or one of its components would result in a significant increase in emissions, even if the increase was completely offset by reductions elsewhere in the plant. The EPA expressed the opinion that this interpretation was more consistent with congressional intent than the plant-wide definition because it would be bring in more sources or modifications for a review. In other words, what they're saying is the executive branch is saying, we're not looking at the text of the statute to find out what this word means. We're making it up as we go. We're being not being univocal. We're being bivivocal. We're being ambiguous. We're not using the term source clearly. We're using it willy-nilly. And we're basing it in an opinion that this interpretation of multiple definitions of the term source is more consistent with congressional intent. That's not based on the language of the text of Congress, though. So, I mean, I keep going back to Congress has to do its job. Congress has to get in the game here and take this more seriously. In 1981, a new administration took office and initiated a government-wide re-examination of regulatory burdens and complexities. What was that new administration? Republican. Republican. Ronald Reagan. Ann Gorsuch was the EPA administrator. That's the mother of Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. 1981, a new administration took office and initiated a government-wide re-examination of regulatory burdens and complexities. In the context of that review, and I'm on page 858 now, the EPA reevaluated the various arguments that had been advanced in connection with the proper definition of the term source and concluded that the term should be given the same definition in both non-attainment areas and PSD areas. That's Republican. The Republicans wanted a clear definition across the board that applies to everybody of the term source. In explaining its conclusion, the EPA first noted that the definitional issue was not squarely addressed. Right here we are, right here. Either in statute or its legislative history, and therefore the issue involved an agency judgment as how to best carry out the act. Okay. It then set forth several reasons for concluding that the plant-wide definition was more appropriate. It pointed out that the dual definition can act as a disincentive to new investment and modernization by discouraging modifications to existing facilities. What could possibly go wrong? And can actually retard progress in air pollution control by discouraging replacement of older, dirtier processes or pieces of equipment with new, cleaner ones. This is the Republicans saying this. And moreover, the new definition would simplify EPA's rules. Wow, that sounds great. That sounds great to me. This is a Republican. They want to simplify EPA's rules by using the same definition of source for PSD, non-attainment new source review, and construction moratorium. This reduces confusion and inconsistency. Wow. Wow. This reduces confusion and inconsistency. That stick that on a coffee mug, man. There's your July quotation for your calendar. It pointed out the dual definition can act as a disincentive to new investment and modernization by discouraging modification to existing facilities, can actually retard process in air pollution control by discouraging replacement of older, dirtier processes or pieces of equipment with new, cleaner ones. The new definition would simplify EPA's rules by using the same definition of source. This reduces confusion and inconsistency. These are Republican goals in regulation, or trying to clear out the arbitrary crap and use logic, define the terms, and then stick with it. Quit trying to make crap up. Finally, the agency explained that additional requirements that remained in place would accomplish the fundamental purposes of achieving attainment with the NAAQS as expeditiously as possible. These conclusions were expressed in a proposed rulemaking in August 1981 that was formally promulgated in October. And that's, of course, what was vacated by, you guessed it. Yep. You didn't have to guess if you're listening to the podcast, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the DC Circuit. That was our first episode. I'm going to stop here. We're going to do seven next time. We're going to do one more on this. We still have some ways to go. I did go a little bit off on the logic textbook, the issue of definitions. So I think that was important to do. So we're going to stop here, and I'm going to bid you adieu until next time. Thanks for being with me on the Republican Professor podcast. It's never been more important to support the Republican Professor. Send your donation in Venmo at the Republican Professor. You can also buy me a coffee at Buy Me a Coffee, Lucas J. Mather. You'll see some links in some of these descriptions on YouTube and on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your descriptions, hopefully. I think you can see them on Apple Podcasts. I can on my iPhone when I pull it up. All right, today is 4 February 2025, years after Jesus, AD, Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. See you later.